A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been watching the news about the ultra-Orthodox party slipping a last-minute 700 million shekel amendment into the budget for yeshivas, on top of 800 million already there, during a war period when partisan bills were supposedly paused. The Attorney General blocked it, the court called it illegal, and the money never moved. But Daniel's question isn't about the politics, it's about the plumbing. When a government transfers money to a ministry, what actually moves? Is there some giant government bank account with a wire transfer button? And when a legal stay hits, what physically stops the payment?
The answer is so much weirder and more interesting than most people imagine. It wasn't a bank freezing an account. It wasn't someone calling a branch manager and saying, "Stop that wire." What actually stopped 700 million shekels was a single authorization code being invalidated in a central bank ledger.
Not a vault door closing, not a swift recall, just a string of digits that the system refused to recognize when the payment instruction hit it.
That little detail, the authorization code is the actual gate, is the thread that pulls you into the entire hidden architecture of sovereign finance. This system determines how every tax dollar moves, how every ministry gets funded, how every government contractor gets paid, and almost nobody understands it.
Which is kind of remarkable. We live in a world where people obsess over the routing number on their paycheck deposit, but when the government moves billions, the public imagination just conjures a Scrooge McDuck vault somewhere with a ledger and a quill pen.
The money bin. That's the mental model for most people. Including, I'd wager, a lot of the journalists covering budget controversies. They report on the political fight, who voted for what, who blocked what, but the actual mechanism that executes or halts the transfer is a black box.
Let's open the box, because this particular controversy is a perfect case study. You've got an asset vote, a legal block, a court ruling, and somewhere in the middle of all that, a piece of software at the Bank of Israel checking a code and saying no.
Here's what makes it especially interesting. The infrastructure that said no in this case is the same infrastructure that processes every government payment, from a defense contractor's invoice to a schoolteacher's salary. It's not some special emergency break. It's the normal operating system of the state's cash flow.
Where do we even start? Because before we can explain what stopped the money, we need to explain what the money actually is in this context. Most people, including Daniel, imagine a bank account. The government has an account. The ministry has an account. Someone presses transfer.
That model is wrong in almost every important way. The Israeli government, and most modern governments, doesn't operate through a collection of separate bank accounts that hold balances. It uses something called a single treasury account.
Which is exactly what it sounds like.
All government revenue, every tax payment, every fee, every fine, flows into one consolidated account at the Bank of Israel, not into the Ministry of Education's account or the Ministry of Defense's account. The government's coffers, in practical terms, are a single ledger entry maintained by the Accountant General.
Ministries don't have money. They have spending authority.
That's the key insight. When the Knesset passes a budget, it's not allocating funds in the sense of moving coins from one pile to another. It's issuing permission slips. Each line item gets an authorization code, and that code is what allows the Accountant General's office to release payments from the single treasury account to the commercial bank accounts that ministries use for their actual operations.
The 700 million shekels for yeshivas was never going to be a pile of cash. It was going to be a permission slip. And the Attorney General's block meant the permission slip was never printed.
More precisely, it was never validated in the system. The Knesset passed the amendment. That's the political act of saying, "We authorize this spending." But the legal block from the Attorney General, followed by the court ruling that the amendment was illegal, meant the authorization code was never entered into the Treasury's payment system as a valid, executable instruction.
This is where the rubber meets the road. Walk me through what happens when a valid payment does go through. If the Ministry of Education needs to pay a contractor, what actually moves?
The Ministry submits a payment request to the Accountant General's office. That office verifies that the request matches an active, valid budget line with an authorization code that checks out. Then it issues a transfer from the single treasury account at the Bank of Israel to the Ministry's operational account at a commercial bank. But here's the crucial detail. That transfer doesn't touch SWIFT, doesn't go through correspondent banks, doesn't enter the international banking system at all.
Because it's an internal central bank settlement.
It moves through the Bank of Israel's real-time gross settlement system, the RTGS. That's a closed network that settles payments between the central bank and commercial banks instantly and irrevocably. The single treasury account gets debited, the commercial bank account gets credited, and the whole thing is just an accounting entry.
When the block happened on the yeshiva funding, the system that would have processed that transfer simply never received a valid authorization code. Any payment instruction referencing that budget line gets rejected at the verification stage.
This is what I find so elegant about the design. The block is granular. It doesn't freeze the Ministry of Religious Services' entire operational account. It doesn't halt other government payments. It just prevents any transaction tagged with that specific budget code from being executed. The rest of the government's cash flow continues uninterrupted.
Which is fundamentally different from how a legal freeze works on a personal bank account. If a court freezes your checking account, everything stops. The block is a sledgehammer. The Treasury's authorization code system is a scalpel.
That scalpel is wielded through software. The Accountant General's payment system maintains a database of valid budget codes. When a payment instruction arrives, the system queries that database. No match, no payment. It's essentially a permissions check, like the one your operating system runs when you try to access a file you don't own.
The entire 700 million shekel controversy reduces to a database query returning access denied.
In technical terms, yes. In political terms, obviously, there's a lot more going on. But the mechanism that enforces the political and legal decisions is, at bottom, a software gate. And that's worth understanding because it means the real power in government finance isn't just who controls the votes, it's who controls the authorization database.
Which brings us to an uncomfortable question about transparency. When the court blocked the disbursement, the public saw headlines about a legal ruling. Nobody saw the actual accounting entry that never happened. Nobody can see the authorization database. The entire system is opaque to citizens.
That opacity creates a major knowledge asymmetry. Insiders, the Accountant General's staff, Treasury officials, senior ministers, understand exactly how the plumbing works. They know that the fight isn't just about passing a bill, it's about getting the code into the system. The public, and frankly most members of Knesset, are arguing about the political surface while the real action happens in the infrastructure layer.
Daniel's question about the actual banking infrastructure turns out to be a question about democratic accountability. If you don't understand that the government's coffers are a single ledger with permission-based disbursement, you can't effectively track whether your elected officials are actually delivering what they voted for.
This model isn't unique to Israel. The United States Treasury maintains a similar structure, the Treasury General Account at the Federal Reserve. The UK has the Consolidated Fund. Most modern sovereign states have converged on this design because it gives the central government extraordinary control over cash flow and prevents the chaos of dozens of ministries independently managing their own bank balances.
That centralization also creates a single point of failure. If the authorization database goes down, or if there's a dispute over who controls the codes, the entire government payment system could theoretically stall.
That's exactly where I want to go next. Because the same architecture that gives you granular control also concentrates risk. And the yeshiva funding controversy is a perfect illustration of both sides of that coin. The controversy itself is straightforward enough. During a war period when the government had publicly committed to pausing partisan legislation, ultra-Orthodox parties pushed through a last-minute amendment adding 700 million shekels for yeshiva funding, on top of the 800 million already in the budget. The Attorney General blocked it, the court ruled the amendment illegal, and the disbursement never happened.
That's where most coverage stopped. Political fallout, accusations of bad faith, some editorials about wartime priorities. But Daniel's instinct was right. The interesting question isn't who won the political fight. It's what actually didn't happen inside the payment system.
Which is why this episode isn't about the politics. It's about the plumbing. What we're looking at is a real-time authorization system processing billions in transactions with database queries, permission checks, and a single point of failure that most citizens don't even know exists.
It's basically an enterprise payments architecture running on a sovereign scale. And the Yeshiva funding block is the perfect failure demo. A live production incident where the authorization layer rejected a transaction and everyone got to see what breaks.
Here's the journey. We need to understand the single treasury account, that consolidated pool at the Bank of Israel where all government revenue lands. Then we trace how a disbursement actually moves from that account to a ministry's operational account through the RTGS. And finally, we look at what happens when a legal block hits, the authorization code that was never issued, the database query that returns null, the payment instruction that dies at the verification gate.
Along the way, we'll see why this system is both more resilient and more fragile than you'd think. Granular control means you can stop one line item without freezing the entire government. But it also means the authorization database is a single point of failure that, if compromised, could halt every payment simultaneously.
The question Daniel asked, what actually stopped the money, turns out to be a question about software architecture, database design, and who holds the keys to the authorization table. That's a much more interesting conversation than another round of coalition politics.
Walk me through the single treasury account itself. You said all government revenue lands in one place at the Bank of Israel. What does that actually look like in practice? Because I think people hear account and still picture something with an account number and a balance they could check on a screen.
It's a ledger maintained by the Accountant General's office, but account is misleading. It's not a bank account in the commercial sense. It's a position on the central bank's books, a record of the government's claim on the monetary base. Every tax payment that lands at a commercial bank eventually gets swept into this single position through the RTGS system.
When I pay my income tax, that money doesn't go to some Israel Tax Authority account. It goes to this consolidated pool, and the tax authority just gets a record that says, corn paid.
The tax authority operates its own subledger for tracking who owes what, but the actual funds, the settlement layer, all sit in one place. The accountant general is the only entity that can authorize outflows from that pool.
Which means every ministry in the government is essentially a dependent child asking the accountant general for an allowance. They have budgets on paper, but they don't control the funds.
That's by design. It prevents exactly the kind of scenario you'd get if the Ministry of Defense had its own giant bank account. A minister could, in theory, issue payments without central oversight. Under the single treasury account model, every disbursement flows through the accountant general's authorization process.
When the Yeshiva funding amendment passed in the Knesset, what actually happened at the accountant general's level? The vote happened. The amendment was technically part of the budget, but the money didn't move.
The vote created the legal basis for an authorization code, but it didn't create the code itself. Think of it as a two-stage process. Stage one is the political authorization. The Knesset says this spending is approved. Stage two is the administrative execution. The Accountant General's office enters the budget line into the payment system with a unique authorization code that the RTGS can reference.
The Attorney General's intervention happened between Stage 1 and Stage 2.
The Knesset passed the amendment, but before the Accountant General's office could generate and validate the authorization code, the Attorney General issued a legal opinion that the amendment was unlawful. It violated the wartime pause on partisan bills. Then the court affirmed that ruling. At that point, the Accountant General's office had no legal basis to issue the code.
The code was never born. It wasn't revoked or frozen. It simply never entered the system.
That distinction matters enormously. If the code had been issued and then revoked, you'd have a different legal situation, potentially a contractual obligation question if payments had already been scheduled. But because the block happened at the authorization stage, there was nothing to revoke. The payment system simply had no record of that budget line as a spendable entity.
Which brings us to the actual technical mechanism. When a ministry wants to spend money, let's say the Ministry of Education needs to pay a textbook supplier, what does that look like from the inside?
the ministry submits a payment order to the Accountant General system. That order references a specific budget code. The system checks the code against the authorization database. If the code is valid and the requested amount is within the authorized limit, the system generates a transfer instruction through the Bank of Israel's RTGS.
That transfer, what actually moves?
Nothing physical, obviously. The central bank debits the single treasury account and credits the commercial bank account that the ministry uses for its operational spending. But the RTGS settlement is instantaneous and final. It's a real-time gross settlement, meaning each transaction settles individually and irrevocably, not in a batch at the end of the day.
The RTGS is the rails, and the authorization database is the gatekeeper. The rails are always open, but the gate only opens for valid codes.
That's what makes the block so precise. The Attorney General's action didn't touch the RTGS infrastructure. It didn't freeze any accounts. It simply ensured that any payment instruction referencing the Yeshiva budget line would fail the authorization check. The system would return, and I'm paraphrasing the actual error here, essentially, budget code not found or not authorized.
Which is a remarkably elegant way to enforce a legal ruling. No one has to seize assets. No one has to freeze an account. The payment simply cannot be initiated because the software won't allow it.
Contrast this with what would happen if a court tried to block a specific payment from your personal checking account. The bank would likely freeze the entire account while they sorted out the legal situation. You'd be locked out of everything. The Treasury's architecture allows surgical intervention. Stop this one thing, leave everything else running.
That surgical precision is why the rest of the government didn't even notice the block happened. The Ministry of Religious Services continued operating. Other budget lines continued disbursing. The $800 million already earmarked for yeshivas, the pre-existing funding, not the contested amendment, presumably continued flowing through its own valid authorization code.
Right, because that $800 million had already been entered into the system with a valid code during the normal budget process. The block only applied to the new $700 million added through the contested amendment. Two different budget lines, two different authorization codes, two different fates.
The entire controversy, at the infrastructure level, was a database entry that never got created. 700 million shekels, gone, from the system's perspective, because a code was never issued.
That's the thing I find most striking about this architecture. The power to stop government spending doesn't require seizing anything. It just requires preventing a number from being entered into a database. The Attorney General didn't need to freeze assets or block transfers. The court didn't need to issue an injunction against a bank. They just needed to ensure the Accountant General never typed that code.
Which raises the question, who actually controls that database? Because if the authorization system is the real gate, then the person who manages the authorization table has an extraordinary amount of power.
The Accountant General, ultimately. They report to the Ministry of Finance, and they're bound by legal opinions from the Attorney General and rulings from the courts. But at the operational level, it's the Accountant General's staff who maintain the authorization database. They're the ones who enter budget codes, set spending limits, and configure the rules that the payment system enforces.
In theory, if there were ever a dispute between the Accountant General and the Attorney General about whether a code should be issued, the system itself doesn't resolve that dispute. It just waits for someone with the right credentials to either enter the code or not.
That's where the political layer and the infrastructure layer collide. The Knesset can pass all the budget amendments it wants. But if the Accountant General, acting on an Attorney General's opinion, refuses to enter the authorization code, the money doesn't move. The political victory is hollow without the administrative execution.
Which is exactly what happened here. The ultra-Orthodox parties got their amendment through the Knesset. They won the vote. And then they discovered that winning the vote and getting the money are two entirely different things. That concentration of control cuts both ways. We've been talking about how elegant the authorization code system is. Surgical blocks, no account freezes, the rest of the government humming along. But there's a flip side. The single treasury account is a single point of failure.
Not in a theoretical sense. If the authorization database goes down, whether from a cyber attack, a software bug, or even a legal dispute over who has the credentials to enter codes, every government payment stops. Not just the controversial ones. Defense contractors, hospital suppliers, teacher salaries.
The same architecture that gives you surgical precision also gives you a single throat to choke.
That's the trade-off, and different countries have made different choices about how to manage it. Treasury General Account at the Federal Reserve operates on the same basic principle: consolidated funds, authorization-based disbursement, but they built in more decentralization through something called apportionment warrants.
Break that down.
When Congress appropriates money, the Office of Management and Budget issues apportionments that distribute the funding authority to agencies over time, quarterly, for example. Each agency then draws from its apportioned share through the Treasury's payment system. It's still a single account at the Fed, but the spending authority is distributed more broadly. The Accountant General in Israel exercises tighter central control.
Which means the Israeli model is more vulnerable to a single authorization failure. If the Accountant General's office can't or won't issue codes, the whole system seizes up.
Whereas in the EU, if there's a dispute over one agency's apportionment, the others keep spending. It's a more federated permission structure on top of the same consolidated settlement layer.
That difference becomes visible during a EU. When appropriations lapse, the Treasury can't issue new payment instructions for non-essential spending, national parks close, passport processing stops. But mandatory spending continues. Social Security checks still go out. Medicare still pays claims. Because those authorization codes were established by permanent law, not annual appropriations. They remain valid even when the rest of the budget is frozen.
The shutdown isn't a freeze of the Treasury General Account. It's a mass expiration of authorization codes for discretionary spending. The codes for mandatory spending don't expire. The payment system keeps running. It just has fewer valid codes to process.
The Yeshiva funding block is essentially a miniature, targeted shutdown. One code never activated. Everything else proceeds.
That's why the political fight shifted to such a technical question. The ultra-Orthodox parties passed the amendment. They won the legislative battle. But the real fight was whether the authorization code would be generated. That's a much less visible battle. No dramatic floor votes, no headlines about parliamentary procedure, just a database entry that either happens or doesn't.
The UK's system works the same way. The Consolidated Fund at the Bank of England holds all government revenue, and Parliament's votes on supply resolutions are essentially authorization triggers. If a legal block hits a specific spending line, the code never activates. The political victory in the Commons is meaningless without the administrative execution at the bank.
Which brings us to the transparency problem. When the Attorney General blocked the Yeshiva funding, the public saw the court ruling. They saw the political accusations flying back and forth. What they didn't see, what they can't see, is the authorization database. There's no public ledger showing which codes are active and which aren't.
You get this knowledge asymmetry. Insiders know the money was stopped because a code was never entered. Outsiders are still arguing about the Knesset vote as if that settled the matter.
That asymmetry distorts democratic accountability. A member of Knesset can vote for a budget amendment, go home to their constituents, and say, "I delivered the funding." Technically true, they voted for it. But if the authorization code was blocked, the money never moved. The constituent has no way to verify what actually happened at the infrastructure level.
Unless they understand the plumbing, which is why this conversation matters beyond the specific controversy. Once you know that government disbursement runs on authorization codes rather than account balances, you start asking different questions about every budget story.
There's another dimension to the resilience question. We talked about the block being surgical, one code, one line item. But what if someone tried to bypass the system entirely? Say a rogue minister decided to order a direct payment from their ministry's commercial bank account, ignoring the Accountant General's authorization process.
They'd be in for a surprise.
The bank would reject the payment. Because the ministry's operational account doesn't actually hold the funds, it's just a pass-through. The real money is in the single treasury account, and it only moves when the accountant general initiates an RTGS transfer. The ministry's commercial account has whatever balance was last transferred into it for operational expenses, typically just enough to cover near-term obligations.
The system is self-enforcing. You can't steal from an account that's empty until the central authority fills it.
Which is brilliant from a control perspective, but it also means there's no fallback. if the RTGS system goes down, or if the authorization database is corrupted, no ministry can access alternative funds. There's no decentralized reserve. Every shekel of government spending flows through one pipe.
That pipe is a tempting target. Imagine a cyber attack that specifically targets the authorization code database, not to steal money, but to corrupt the codes. Suddenly, every payment instruction fails validation. The entire government payment system halts until someone can reconstruct which codes are valid.
That's the nightmare scenario for Treasury security teams. And it's not hypothetical. Central bank RTGS systems have been targeted before. The difference is that a commercial bank can fall back on correspondent relationships or alternative settlement mechanisms. A sovereign treasury with a single treasury account has no plan B. The STA is the only game in town.
Which makes the authorization database the most valuable piece of infrastructure that nobody talks about, more critical than any individual ministry systems, more sensitive than most intelligence databases. And yet it's maintained by a relatively small team in the Accountant General's office, operating on proprietary software that gets almost no public scrutiny.
That's the tension at the heart of this architecture. It's elegant, it's efficient, it prevents the chaos of decentralized government banking. But it concentrates risk in a way that most citizens, and frankly, most legislators, don't appreciate. The same system that made the Yeshiva block so clean and surgical is the system that could, under different circumstances, become the single point of failure for an entire state's cash flow. What do you actually do with all of this the next time you see a budget headline?
That's the practical question, and I think the single most useful mental shift is this. Stop picturing bank accounts. When you hear that a court blocked 700 million shekels, don't imagine a vault door closing. Ask whether the authorization code was ever issued.
Because that's the real indicator of whether money is moving. The legal system doesn't freeze government funds the way it freezes your checking account. It invalidates the permission to spend. In the Yeshiva case, the court ruled the amendment illegal, so the code was never generated. No code, no payment. The money was never at risk of being dispersed because the system had no record that it was allowed to exist.
That's the second shift. Ministries don't hold cash. They hold spending authority. Their budget is a permission slip, not a balance. The actual funds sit in one place, the single treasury account, and only move when the accountant general validates a code and pushes a transfer through the RTGS.
Which is fundamentally different from how you or I or any business manages money. If your company's budget says you have 50,000 shekels for marketing, that money is actually sitting in a bank account somewhere with your company's name on it. A government ministry's budget line is just an entry in an authorization table. The cash is elsewhere, and the ministry can't touch it directly.
Next time you see a headline about a budget dispute, whether it's yeshiva funding in Israel, a U government shutdown, or a spending fight in Westminster, the question to ask is not, did they pass the bill? It's, was the authorization code issued or blocked?
That one question cuts through most of the political noise. A parliament can vote for spending all day long. If the authorization code never enters the payment system, the vote was theater.
Once you start thinking this way, you notice how much budget coverage misses the infrastructure layer entirely. Journalists report the vote count, the political maneuvering, the angry quotes from opposition leaders. Almost nobody asks whether the code is live in the system.
Which makes you a more informed consumer of news than most of the people producing it. That leads to a question I keep turning over. As governments digitize further, and Israel's treasury has been pushing digital transformation for years, does this system become more automated? More rule-based? Could you eventually reach a point where the authorization codes are generated and validated by software without human legal review?
That's the direction of travel, isn't it? Right now, a human being in the Accountant General's office has to enter the code. A human Attorney General has to issue the legal opinion. A human court has to rule. But if you wire the authorization system directly into the legislative process, Knesset passes a bill, the system automatically generates the code. You eliminate the administrative bottleneck.
Which sounds efficient until you realize you've also eliminated the point where legal oversight can intervene. In the Yeshiva case, the Attorney General stopped the process between the vote and the code generation. If that step is automated away, the money moves the moment the vote tally hits the database.
Automation could actually weaken legal checks by removing the human gatekeeper. The same infrastructure that gave us a surgical block could, with a different configuration, make blocks impossible.
Then there's the cyber attack scenario. If you automate code generation, you're essentially giving software the keys to the entire government's cash flow. A compromised system doesn't just fail to block bad payments, it could generate fraudulent authorization codes at scale.
Imagine malware that creates phantom budget lines with valid-looking codes. By the time a human auditor catches it, the RTGS has already settled the transfers. Real-time gross settlement means real-time irreversible loss.
Which is why I think the future of this architecture is probably something in between. More automated verification against a live legal database, but with human override points baked in. Every payment gets checked against current court rulings, attorney general opinions, and budget authorizations in real time. The system flags anomalies, but a person still has to approve the final release.
That's both powerful and concerning. Powerful because you could catch irregularities instantly. No more waiting for an auditor to discover something months later. Concerning, because the person with final approval authority becomes the most targeted individual in the government. Every hacker, every hostile intelligence service, every corrupt insider would want their credentials.
The same infrastructure that blocked the yeshiva funding could become a real-time budget control system of unprecedented precision. And that precision cuts both ways. It could prevent abuse, or it could enable it, depending on who controls the database.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1783, a Nepalese woodcarver's guild manual specified that the handle of a master's adze must be carved from rhododendron wood harvested only during the waxing moon of the month of Mengsir, claiming the sap alignment made the tool less likely to split during intricate relief work.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed this deep dive into government plumbing, rate and review the show. It helps others find these weird, fascinating topics. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. We'll be back.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.